Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Ann Lodge Insurance Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lagler, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Ann Lodge Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of the Ann Lodge Deterrence Center. And today we have a great guest, a friend of mine, of course, and that's Dr. Kevin Cooney, and he is the president of Wilberforce International Institute, which is an organization that is, you know, it's a Christian-based organization that trains international students in the U.S. to go back to their countries and be agents for good. And he's also a PhD in international relations who specializes in Japan. And you may be wondering, okay, so how is this relevant to NucleCast? Well, I'll explain. So what I wanted to do is talk about a subject we have never talked about before, and that is the morality of nuclear weapons. And Kevin is both somebody who understands international relations and is a theologian. I thought he would be a great person to talk about this topic. And being a specialty, you know, a specialty is Japan, the only place we've ever used them, even better. So with that, Kevin, welcome to NucleCast.
Thank you very much, Adam. I look forward to talking with you and your guests today.
So we're going to talk about the morality of nuclear weapons. This is kind of a huge topic, and it's one that, you know, people often have sort of vague views, and they either generally say, they're good, or they're bad, and or they're just a necessity. They're, you know, we can't unbuild them, and so therefore they are what they are. Now, as we look at it from sort of a moral perspective, and we look at, you know, just war theory, which has a long tradition of looking at, you know, within, you know, it's within, started within Catholic tradition, and then it's been broadened across Christendom to, you know, it's something that has been ensconced in international law. As you look at, as you try to apply this to just war and international law to nuclear weapons, can you sort of walk us through what just war theory says and what international law, how does, you know, what do they say about conflict and what do they say about, you know, nuclear weapons in particular?
Well, when you, let's kind of backtrack from nuclear war into just war in general, from the Christian and the moral perspective. My master's degree was in international relations strategic studies. And with strategic studies, it was back in the 80s. Cold War was in full bloom. I was studying in Europe, which was the epicenter of the East-West conflict. And the idea is, what would we do in war? And this was a big challenge for me in working this through with my Christian faith, but also working it through from the idea of the state's responsibility to its citizens to protect them. Because there's a difference between individual action and state action. Because individuals, where's our responsibility? The state, where is the state's responsibility on that? And so you got two different things, but it doesn't, they don't need to be in conflict, but there is an overlap, but there is two different goals there. And when we look at the idea of war, I don't think anybody would say that war is a good. War is hell by any definition. And we have to deal with the idea of the fact that there are going to be atrocities in war when war happens. War happens because we have evil in this world. We have bad people. We could name names, but I won't bother. You can probably pop into mind already some people that are bad. But the thing is, how do we conduct ourselves in war? How do we prevent ourselves if we consider ourselves good and not the perpetrators of war? How do we stop the war in a just way. And when you look at the concept of, which in Christian tradition, there is a concept called just war theory. And it comes from the writings of St. Augustine, the great Christian theologian from the 5th century. Go back also St. Thomas Aquinas. And it's an amalgamation there. A lot of it has come from the Catholic tradition, but also it's been developed by Protestants and what have you, as they look at this idea of just war and the actions within that war that are so important about our own morality and about who we are, that we don't become the evil that we're trying to eliminate in some type of conflict. And it's assuming we're on the good side on that. Right. So, for example, the idea when you think one other thing I want to say is there's also a strong historical tradition of pacifism too, that just says all war is evil, and that, for example, Christians, and there's other religions out there that oppose war on the fact is that you are participating in war and you cannot do it, and there's a pacifist tradition that we must take what happens and let God handle the rest. So there's a two competing in there, and then there's a even smaller tradition that just is like the state and everything like that, and we can just do what the state needs us to do, what have you. But that's a very, very small minority that's kind of in that area, to give you the broad spectrum of Christianity. What I talk about in terms of Christianity, I'm talking from my faith and what knowing, but I know enough that you can find all of these traditions within Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, and what have you, in this diversity of opinion on how to handle war to different extents. But I'm going to give everything today from the Christian perspective, because that's what I know best. So I'm not excluding other traditions there. They are out there and they have their own traditions on it, but mostly as I'm going to talk about it from the Christian perspective on that. Sure. So that maybe is kind of a first getting in there. But the idea is, when you look at a just war, the war that's held up most often is World War II as a just war, because it was stopping the evil of Nazism and fascism and the horrors of it. But in the thing of just war, there's a couple principles. The idea is that it's a just cause. So in there, it was stopping the evil of Nazism. Right intent. Part of the thing is it's not for vengeance. It's not for something. It's to stop the evil that's occurring. Net benefit is that the benefit of what stopping it outweighs the cost of waging the war. It's done by a legitimate authority. This gets into a trigger because it really flies in the face of a lot of, say, Marxian revolutionary groups and what have you, that says only the state can wage war. Groups cannot do revolutionary insurgencies, that sort of thing, on that actually falls outside of the conditions of just war. And then people say, well, what about the American Revolution? Well, there's a certain level in there that they elected representatives, they declared war, and what have you, with the Declaration of Independence, etc., and so on. So the nuances there. I would, if you want to take a look at just war, I'm going to make a shameless pitch for somebody who I don't get any benefit, but a good friend of mine, actually two good friends, Mark David Hall and Daryl Charles. They wrote this thing, America and the Just War Tradition, Notre Dame Press, a few years back. I think it's like was 2018, 2019. They actually look at each of America's wars in the just war tradition and through a series of historians looking at them, determining whether they are just wars. The other principles of just war that still there is last resort, that it's not the first choice that they do, proportionality of means. And I'm going to refer to that later as we talk in the podcast. So remember that, and right conduct in the way you conduct yourself in the war, that you don't allow yourself to debase yourself into this pure animalistic and the evil that you're actually trying to stop. So those are the main principles of just war.
And, you know, I think those are all ones that we're largely familiar with. And as you think, you know, as I think through the conflicts that have happened in my lifetime and the way that we've generally acted and the way that U.S. service members have acted in those wars, we tend to follow those elements of just war. Now, as you add into the mix nuclear weapons, because this has been, you know, there's, if you follow the debate between, you know, right now we've got two peer competitors in China who is, you know, has building an arsenal rapidly that will equal the United States or exceed it. The Russians already exceed the U.S. arsenal. The North Koreans are dramatically increasing the size of theirs. You know, Iran is sitting on the precipice of having its own nuclear arsenal. And so there's a view that, you know, now is a time for the U.S. to be growing its arsenal. And then within the disarmament community, there's a pushback that says, hey, listen, guys, nuclear weapons are fundamentally immoral because they could kill large amounts of people. So as you sort of take this broader argument and put it within the context of just war and international law and these efforts to, you know, limit civilian casualties and all of the things that we do to constrain war, how do you see that and how do you rationalize it? And you know, what should the listeners understand about that?
Okay. Looking at this, I was originally trained, my undergraduate degree was in history, so I like to take things from a historical and then build them into the present as my style as an academic, even to this day. Let's look at the first use of atomic weapons. And I also just, I use atomic weapons as a term as opposed to you're more technical in this, but we measure modern nuclear weapons in terms of like how many Hiroshimas and Nagasakis they equal. These were a lot less than what our modern weapons can do, which are much, much more potent and dangerous. But in our first use of it was against Japan. And let's set some context here. The war against Japan started with Pearl Harbor for the United States, but had been ongoing for more than a decade of tensions between Western powers, Japan, and Japan's imperialistic ambitions in Asia that were there. The precipice of it was the sanctions that were put on Japan and realizing it was strangling their economy, and they chose war as the solution with the attack on Pearl Harbor. To further put this is, Japan went toe-to-toe with the United States in a way that was that they gave as good as they got. They just didn't have the resources that the United States did, both in manpower, industrial complex, and things that famously Admiral Yamamoto warned his people about before they engaged in the war. So the thing is, the war is going badly for Japan. The Japanese main islands are about ready to basically be invaded. And I know a lot about it. I won't go into this test. I interviewed Major General Frank Sacton, who is a professor at ASU. I don't know if you ever met him while you were there, but he was an incredible source. He was MacArthur's chief aide during the occupation. He was going to be the highest ranking commander that was going to hit the beaches in Japan in November 45. The invasions were planned. The final orders weren't given, but they were planned. He knew what they were going to do. He had some great insights. So that was there. What he didn't know about at the time was the Manhattan Project and the nuclear bombs targeted to Hiroshima. And then later, in many ways, and I won't get into this, but it was a tragic accident in Nagasaki. It was just the way the orders were transmitted that they continued bombing when basically the initial order was supposed to be only for one bombing to try to get Japan into surrender. Now, this is where morality gets into the ideas. This was a horrendous thing. I mean, dropping on Hiroshima, just to focus on it, in its epicenter there, the bomb going off 3.5 mile, basically radius, everything is destroyed, all life there. Further out, you have burns, some radiation sickness, other things, and then further out, then it's other things, and then that's it. So that You look at that. However, let's contextualize this. At the time, General Curtis LeMay of the Allied bombing campaign was firebombing major cities. The reason Hiroshima was a target was it was being held off intentionally from the bombing to demonstrate the impact of a single atomic bomb. So it was just kind of interesting. Same thing with Nagasaki. They thought they were being lucky in not being bombed. But the fact is, they were being held off intentionally as targets. But the firebombing of Tokyo, of Osaka, of Nagoya, of these cities, and I'm going to recommend something. There's the movie The Fog of War, won the Oscar for Best Documentary back, I want to say, in 2002, 2003. It gives the interest. It's an interview with McNamara, who was part of Curtis LeMay's Allied bombing campaign. And they recognized what they were doing with the bombing was setting cities on fire, not just bombing military targets, but cluster bombs that would set the things on fire. And the Japanese architecture, which was based a lot on wood that was dried, what have you, and their type of things, like you can maybe picture it in your mind when you think of Japanese architecture, it burned very fast. And it burned literally millions alive. And that was just horrendous things on that. We don't talk about those firebombings today as much. There's only one very small museum in Tokyo that I visited that commemorates that. But for most part, the Japanese want to forget about it. We want to forget about it because, as Curtis LeMay said to his staff, he says, if we lose this war, we will all be tried and executed as war criminals. And that's a very potent thing because they recognized this was total warfare. I said America and Japan were going toe to toe. And the Japanese themselves estimated that over 5 million casualties in an invasion, if the Allies invaded Japan, that Japan would lose. We estimated a little bit less than that, but the thing is, you're talking millions. Now, how many people died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? You've got under 200,000
100,000,
versus millions. Now, do you equate, and this is the moral question, do you equate it? Is it simply the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, to use the thing that Spock talks about in Star Trek? It is a very tough thing to consider, but the thing is, when people say the atomic bombing was immoral in absolute terms and the use of them, I say, but what is the consequence of not using them? Millions of people would have died. I mean, I look at it, my own father-in-law lived in Japan. He was just coming of age. He was too young to have fought in World War II. But if the war had continued, it would have been like as in Nazi Germany, where they were drafting young boys into the final defense of Berlin. It would have been the thing is, and all the things you think about the consequences of a continued war. The shock of the bombings convinced the emperor to, for the first time, vote in a cabinet meeting to say end the war and break the stalemate between this. It was a seven-member cabinet, and it was a 3-3 tie, and he broke the tie in order to surrender. That is the in the end is the thing, and that was the thing. We have the modern Japan that we have, that who's a good ally of America, who is a modern third greatest largest economy in the world, and Japan is what it is today, partially because of the atomic bombings. And Hiroshima is a thriving city today. Nagasaki is a thriving city. I have been in both cities on the memorial days and participated in the memorial ceremonies for those lives who were lost, but I participated in those cities and stood at ground zero. And the thing is,
So,
they're there.
yeah,
So
go ahead and
that is the memorial, or that is the background when you took in this. So the absolute use of nuclear weapons. Now we get into then the Cold War. And maybe you want to follow up with questions with me to keep me from just lecturing, and I don't want to get into that. As a professor, I kind of tend to get into that mode, but.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
So as we, you know, let's suppose we say, okay, well, those two examples were justified. You know, the use, you know, Japan attacked the United States. These, you know, we were firebombing. That was more destructive. In the end, we used nuclear weapons to end the war. So we'll accept that those were moral uses of nuclear weapons. But today we have, you know, each, you know, the United States, Russia, China, Great Britain, France, North Korea, India, Pakistan, we have thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons. And so our moral obligation is to eliminate all of those nuclear arsenals. That's the only moral choice to have is disarmament and elimination of nuclear weapons. And that's what many, you know, within the disarmament community would argue. So how would you address that in terms of, is that the correct moral position? Is it, you know, outside of, you know, just war? What say you in terms of sort of the position that, that many folks have taken?
Yeah, and that's a great question. Now, contextualize again, in the situation with Japan at the end of World War II, you had one side with the weapons, other side didn't. So there was no chance of a global exchange that we existed during the Cold War. Now, as you contextualize, the idea is when you go against a peer with nuclear weapons, my definition of a peer is each side is capable of destroying the other side as a civilization.
Sure.
And is there any morality in that? And the answer is really no. But this also gets into the ideas you can't uninvent nuclear weapons. I mean, the only nation that is said to have basically had nuclear weapons and given them up is South Africa, where they gave that they destroyed all knowledge and their weapons and things like that before ending the apartheid government and handing over to black majority rule in Africa there. But the thing is, for the most part, you don't have examples of nations that have given up nuclear weapons. And they're the great equalizer in terms of power, because when you can have your civilization threatened by a much smaller nation, you're less inclined to be aggressive and you're more careful in your behavior. So some people say that nuclear weapons are the ultimate deterrent. In fact, there have been scholars who have argued that just arm everybody with nuclear weapons and we will have no war because nobody could ever use them. But the argument against that is we obviously have madmen out there and crazies who would do it. And I'll put one person's name right on the table who very bluntly told McNamara in the 90s that he would have used nuclear weapons, and that was Castro in the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was over his objections that the Soviets didn't use them, and he had, but the thing is, the Soviets had exclusive control over their weapons in Cuba, and they wouldn't do it. But he was kind of like, let's use them and let the chips fall where they may. And that attitude is not something, when you're looking at nuclear weapons, they are the ultimate indiscriminate weapon because they can destroy in a flash a whole entire city. Everything that has been built. I mean, if you look out your window into your community, whether it's a small city, just imagine everything gone in an instant.
So I wonder if you take... So take the Cold War. This is a great example. And if we look at World War I and World War II, where we lost more than 100 million people in those conflicts, they were tremendously devastating, you know, in terms of lives lost, in terms of the destruction to nations, in terms of, you know, economic capacity loss. I mean, the U.S. spent half of the gross domestic product to fight World War II. I mean, half of everything created in this nation went to the war effort. And I wonder if, you know, by virtue of having nuclear weapons for the United States and the Soviet Union, and let's say that they contributed, played an important role in the U.S. and Soviet Union not fighting World War III. Would the weapons themselves then not have served a moral good by virtue of preventing war?
And that would be the argument that could be made, is if both sides had been armed with nuclear weapons, would World War I have happened? And you look at the millions of lives lost, whole generations on all sides lost. That would be, you could say, if that would have been a deterrent. And in deterrence theory, that's the idea, is do something and have something that basically gets your opponent to not do something they would have done otherwise. Now, the problem with deterrence theory is you never know unless it fails. People can say wasn't deterred. But the thing is, would it have deterred? I think in a rational World War I, yes. I think in Europe, you would have had an incredible stalemate. But then it's also, when you look at the atrocities that, say, the Nazis perpetrated in the areas that they controlled. And this is the other thing, is when you start having conventional aggression where both sides are nuclear armed, and the fear is that no one wants to get to the nuclear end, so there is a restraint used in response, you can still have war. And I think we're experiencing that right now when we're seeing in Ukraine. You have the Russians, a nuclear power, against a non-nuclear power, and the Ukrainians are fighting there. And in another time and era, you might have had more Western power, or, you know, more aggressively actually send troops or something like that. But you do not want a direct conflict between nuclear powers, because as things go bad for one side or the other, there's the temptation to resort to the use of nuclear weapons. And there's this whole idea, can we have a controlled, limited nuclear war where it's just focused on the battlefield? And that is a huge question. And I fall on the side, each side is going to up the ante a little bit. And then something goes wrong, and one side feels they have to teach the other side a lesson. And then we start getting attacks on civilians and cities. And then that's the whole argument. Are there innocent civilians when you have societies basically producing the machinery for war? When you see half of U.S. GDP was dedicated to World War II, how much were the American citizens at home, in whether they were in New York, Kansas, Missouri, California, whatever, participating in the war effort? And the answer is they were heavily participating. So does that make them legitimate targets? And you start sitting and you go down this ideological or intellectual path, and maybe then you can start justifying the use, but do you have to backtrack and take the larger view and realize, wait, this is a civilization. What about their wives, their children who are not part of this and are caught up in the same sort of thing?
Well, let me ask you very pointedly, because I don't want to run out of time. And that is, does a nuclear weapon have any inherent morality? And what I ask is it seems that nuclear weapons, particularly amongst those who would like to see them go away, that there is an imputation of sort of moral actorness, you know, that they are somehow moral actors. And that this is imputed to nuclear weapons in a way that it's not imputed to, you know, an M1 Abrams tank or an F-35 or, you know, you pick another warfighting platform. And, you know, my premise is that they're neither good nor bad. You know, they're tools of war, and tools of war can be used for good purposes or bad purposes. But there's nothing inherently moral about nuclear weapons. Am I right or am I wrong on that?
I would, and I want to qualify this for your listeners, I'm open to persuasion on this answer. I'm not dead set on it. But I would say there's an inherent deterrent value of nuclear weapons in controlling conflict. I mean, there were conflicts like Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan during the Cold War. But there was a lot of cap on global violence because of that conflict. There was no stopping atrocities being committed in areas that were under the sphere of the influence of one side or the other, but it was at least, it was controlled for great power conflict. You take a look as you know, when the Cold War ended, it was like this New World Order, and it very quickly became the New World Disorder. I mean, you had the first Persian Gulf War, the second one, you had 9/11, you got conflicts going in Afghanistan. You've got this, I mean, when you look at the number of conflicts that have gone on globally in the last 30 years since the Cold War ended, it's been a pretty rough time. I mean, the U.S. has been really involved in conflict everywhere, and that's just the United States. And we look around the world and we see these conflicts. But the thing is, what was taken away in some ways was that nuclear deterrent factor. But at the same time, it's never gone away. Russia, as you know, very correctly, has still more weapons. Yes, they're less than half of what they were at the peak of the Cold War, and the same thing with the United States. But they're still enough to destroy not only each other's civilization, but multiple civilizations. So the thing is, sure, that deterrent factor adds a little bit. An M1 tank, if you're sitting in a building, may be a deterrent for you doing something because the tank can destroy your building, but it also may not be the ultimate deterrent. A nuclear weapon, if you're irrational, it's a deterrent from doing certain actions and what have you if you're a political leader. But the thing is, note the key word I use, rational. Assumed rationality. And that is one of the worries there. The crazy person walking on the street, we've all seen them in cities and stuff, they may have mental health, whatever you, to them, they are perfectly rational. They assume themselves to be rational. Whereas to others, they may not appear to be rational. When you get a leader who thinks like, say, Fidel Castro, because it's all about the idea, the ideology, all about the revolution, all about that, that he said, yeah, let the United States and Soviet Union, will go, and it would destroy his Cuban civilization because it would have been a target in any new conflict that erupted. Yet he was willing to do that in a heartbeat, according to his own mouth. That is the scary thing there, is when you get those in there. And that's the worry about nuclear weapons as this ultimate deterrent, because if they're used, then things get out of control, because the only response to the use of a weapon of mass destruction like a nuclear weapon is a response with that. Otherwise, there is no such thing as deterrence.
So we're at that time in the show where we like to bring out Bob the genie. And if I rub my magic lamp and Bob, of course, pops out and he grants 3 wishes to all guests. So if you've got 3 wishes, but they're solely related to the topics that we're discussing, this idea of, you know, and from our discussion, it seems to me pretty clear that there's no real clear answer as to whether nuclear weapons or conflict is inherently moral or immoral. It's sort of, it depends and context matters. Mm-hmm. So if I said that, if I summarized that correctly, then Bob's given you 3 wishes. So what would your 3 wishes be?
Okay. I'm going to take this into a round. I mean, the most obvious one is say, okay, wish all nuclear knowledge and nuclear weapons away. but what does the world look like? Are we on World War 5, 6, 7 by now? Possibly. Sure. And so the thing is, I look at that wish and think, okay, I don't want to do it. My wish is like, if you've ever watched the movie 13 Days, a fictionalized account of the Cuban Missile Crisis, they talk in the end about good men. And the thing is, the realization that we can't do the ultimate and push that fictional big red button of launching nuclear weapons and setting civilizations there is, I want good men, good women in leadership to understand the weight of their actions and understand the fact that they need to allow people to be people. Recognize that not everything is in control. And the example, this is one of the things is that I see when I travel the world. I've currently have up to 69 different countries I've traveled to, lived in my life. And oftentimes it's this desire, particularly in authoritarian regimes, to control everything. Is that people will allow people to be free to make their independent decisions and what have you, and not try to dictate and do things and recognize not everything will always go my way. This goes to Chinese businessmen, American business people, all those things that when they go, they can't control and lock things in. You need to have that independence. You need to have standards that basically respect fellow men. I mean, we're sitting here recording this just before Christmas, and goodwill and peace on earth toward men. That's a wish that I would like to see. And the thing is that people respect people for their differences, allow for people for the differences. And the thing is that, yes, I may not like your ideas. I may argue against them, but I respect your ability to have those things. And this goes completely against the, I'm going to step on a landmine here, is the entire cancel culture and this idea out there that you have to think just one way. Let me persuade you. And I recently heard a different podcast from a woman who was part of the Westboro Baptist Church. She was part of that family that protested military members' funerals and what have you. And I thought that was a horrible thing and whatever, what they were doing, and insensitive and the best thing. And the note that was that church had nothing connection to any other Christian group or what have you. But this woman was part of that. And then, but people approaching her and talking with her eventually made her realize the error of her ways. And she was in this podcast was talking about it wasn't people yelling and screaming at me and canceling me. It was basically them talking with me and coming to understand me and then I understanding them and doing that. And that's the way we do things. So if I were going to wish for something, is wish for more dialogue and understanding. America and Japan are very different. In fact, actually, when I look at I see so much, and I'm a big sci-fi fan, and particularly Star Trek, on that. And I look at the model of the Klingons, which were the ultimate enemy in the early original Star Trek and what have you. And I see how much that Roddenberry and the other model the Klingon culture after Japan, because it was the most foreign to our American way of thinking. Yet we're the best of allies to this day now. But the part of the thing is we came to understand, and that to cycle back to my, those interviews I did with Frank Sacton, he went into Japan hating the Japanese with a passion because he had commanded troops in the Philippines, had seen atrocity. I mean, he said, living there among them, coming to understand them during the occupation, my own morality, not seeking vengeance, etc. and so on. He came to respect the Japanese tremendously, and it changed how he viewed it. And that's the part of the thing is we need more people talking and understanding and the willingness to say, hey, it's okay that I don't agree with you and you don't agree with me. Let's continue the dialogue. And that's what I think happens, especially when we talk about nation states. And so you look at things and we fought, people don't remember, several wars with Canada. Not since it's been Canada, but under British control, other things, we've invaded it during our revolution, other things like that. But you say we have the longest undefended border in the world. We've come to understand each other. We still have disputes. I live here in the Pacific Northwest. So yeah, you just go off on Puget Sound and there's fishing arguments that go back and forth in our respective coast guards trying to enforce, like, the fish don't know where the international boundary is. But that's where I want to see is the understanding where we dialogue about it. We don't go to war with each other about it and we work it through. So I don't know how many wishes I put in there, but that's the general thing. Goodwill and peace on earth.
Well, that's always, I guess, especially when you're talking on a podcast about morality, you know, goodwill and peace on earth is certainly a welcome thing to have. Now, unfortunately, we are out of time on this podcast. So, Kevin, thanks for joining us and thanks for sort of trying to, what's the right word, mull through all of these difficult, you know, kind of discussions and debates about morality. It's pretty clear that there's a lot of it depends, and a lot of the context matters, and so it's not a simple and clear answer in terms of, are nuclear weapons moral or are they not? It's there's much more to it. And you know, I liked your wish when you said you wish for a lot of, you know, good men and good women, because those difficult decisions, you know, hopefully we'll have the good men and good women there who will make those decisions. Mm-hmm. So thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Thank you, Adam, for having me, and have a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Same to you. And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. Yeah, so that was an interesting discussion. You know, Kevin is both a theologian and a political scientist. And, you know, thinking through just war theory and morality and war, you know, it's a pretty complex issue that perhaps doesn't have any, you know, sort of absolute, you know, easy set of rules that you can just follow. You know, it's sort of a lot of it depends. And so that discussion was certainly interesting. I'm not sure I you know, now know, have any sort of much deeper understanding of morality and nuclear war, because I'm not sure. I think that this, perhaps one of the things to walk away from it with, was it's really not that clear. And it's a lot of it depends. So I don't know. Maybe you had a different take.
This has been a production of the Amla Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Frontline. Help us grow our followers by sharing and